Hi there, my name is Emily Stone, actually Dr. Emily Stone, but I hope in these conversations you will think of and refer to me as just Emily. I am a marriage and family therapist and have a long history of work in local churches. I also teach in an accredited graduate school program that trains marriage and family therapists. Issues related to growth, formation, relationships, and spirituality are passions of mine. Throughout our life, we hit seasons where we get stuck in an area of our lives, and because all of our various parts are connected, we often get stuck in a few areas all at once. In this podcast, I have one goal: to create spaces for brave conversations around places where we get stuck. I'm so glad you have joined us today for conversations with some pretty amazing people. People like you. Hi, everyone. Today, I get to share with you Greg and Helms Jarrell from QC Family Tree right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. It would be impossible to cover quickly in a short introduction everything that Greg and Helms do in this community. They are each in their own unique ways, community builders, parents, activists, artists, pastors, and good friends. And Greg just added author to that list. He has a book called A Riff of Love, Notes on Community and Belonging that was just published, and you can get it on Amazon. I hope you will check it out. So we covered some pretty hard topics in this conversation related to power and privilege, but we still managed to get a good amount of laughter in. I hope you will enjoy our dialogue. I know I sure did.
Oh, well, I can be in the crazy club. I'm the girl who shows up to play tennis with the nose ring and three tattoos. So I...
Do you have a tennis skirt? That's what I want to know. Do you have a tennis skirt?
Helms.
A tennis skirt.
You can't.
Helms, I'm wearing it right now.
It's a sport. Is it a sport?
They are all sports, right? No. Mine's a real tennis skirt, but the way it is, where they are now, I have several. So the way they are right now is they have, like, used to you wore bloomers under your skirt, but now, and then some of these bloomers also had pockets where you put the balls.
Right, put a ball.
Yeah. So now you do, they have, like, shorts, these tiny shorts under the skirt, and then you put the ball up in that.
Isn't that just all one thing? It's not just like a... It's two articles of clothing?
No. It's one article of clothing now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure there's still skirts where you wear bloomers, too. I don't have any of those anymore. I gave them away a few years ago.
I've never played tennis in my life.
I've played tennis. So
and
I decided,
he wore a tennis skirt.
When I was in college that I was going to learn... So I took a class, like a PE, you know, I had an elective, had to take a PE class, so I took tennis. And I sort of played off and on and never took it seriously enough to develop any skill. So her dad's last wife, a few years ago, like, she was a pretty avid tennis player, so she knew that I had played a little bit off and on, so she offered for us to go out and play a little bit. And she absolutely, at like 60 or so years old, whooped my 25-year-old ass.
I believe it.
All over the court.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've played since then. That was enough for me.
Hey, I believe it. My partner today, I don't know, she may have been 65. And that woman, I've played with her twice. And she's actually really, really kind and not snobby or anything at all. But she gets balls. I just can't believe it. I cannot believe it. Yeah. So, but this is new for me because I haven't really hardly played at all in 15 years. So, I mean, I played in college, but that's what paid for college for me. So I, what?
Where did you go?
Lee University.
I don't know where that is.
Yeah, it's a small Christian private school in Tennessee. Yeah. I don't know if you've listened to any of mine, but I usually start by saying a little bit about what I remember from the first time I met you guys. So I was thinking about that before we got started. And thank you, by the way, for letting, I mean, the reason I was upstairs and laying down with my youngest daughter. That's why I needed 5 more minutes to get started. So my first memory, of course, is when our church came and, let's see, what is the night when people, when churches can come and help you guys? Yeah. Family night, right? Community. What is it?
Community.
Community night. Okay. You know what? When I talk, I think the way Zoom is, maybe every time I talk, I need to stop for just a second before you start because okay. I don't hear you as well or something. I don't know. Okay.
So it's called community meal.
Community meal. That's right. So my memory is that, like I'm sure you guys hear a lot, that I really loved it. And I was really impressed with the blue strip of hair in Helms's blonde hair. And I don't know if it was blue or pink, but I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure she could be my friend. And then, the way you led us in the song that you guys sing beforehand, I guess as you guys were praying, almost as a prayer, I really loved that. And then I remember Greg saying that he claimed to be an introvert at some point that night. And I was like, oh, and he'd be my friend too. So yeah, I just remember feeling just obvious. I mean, just really impressed with you guys and what you're doing over there. So, and wanted to hear more, which I'm sure you guys get a lot of. So yeah, so I guess I wanted to start. I know I sent you guys some questions, and thank you for being willing to spend time with me. I wanted to ask you guys first just to tell me a little bit, both of you, tell me a little bit about your background, a little bit about your story.
Okay. I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I've only ever had about a 3-hour radius from home. So I went to Appalachian State University for college, and then I ended up going to Baptist Theological Seminary in Richmond. And so we lived in Richmond for 5 years, and we moved to Charlotte from there. In 2005, we moved to Charlotte. So anyway, I grew up raised in a Baptist church, but a more progressive Baptist church that had women in ministry before I was even born. Well, and when I say ministry, probably like as deacons before I was born. So I didn't know anything other than that. And our experience in summer missions, as we were part of the Baptist Student Union of North Carolina and the summer missions program, that and our campus ministry experience and just life experience in general is what kind of made me who I am. So
say that last part again. What experience kind of made you what you are?
Our involvement in summer missions, like college summer missions and service.
Okay.
The first summer I went and spent a summer at Caswell, which is the North Carolina Baptist State Convention has a assembly grounds at Fort Caswell on Oak Island. And I spent my summer on staff there in the dish room. And then the next summer, I served in Puerto Rico with another person named Sherry, and she and I welcomed North Carolina youth groups to come down to Puerto Rico and do mission trips, and we were kind of the liaison between Puerto Rico and the youth groups throughout the summer.
Wow.
And the next summer, I served as in what was called a program called Youth Corps, which was providing youth ministers to rural churches that couldn't afford to have youth ministers otherwise. So they would have these college students come and serve as youth ministers in the summer. And so I worked in Gates County in Hobsville, North Carolina, 45 minutes away from a grocery store. In a time, I mean, like I was grown up as a city girl and lived a city girl life my whole entire life. And that was wow. My only time ever living as rural as that. And it was a really wonderful experience. And then the last summer of my college experience, I served as a youth minister in a church that I had served throughout my senior year of college in Boone. So all that, wow. Plus our campus minister, who was a great mentor to us, his name is Bud Fisher. He lives in Lenore now. that kind of all meshed together. And then we were plopped down in seminary and seminary life and all of that. And our experiences there kind of landed us to where we are here now.
So all of that that you just described happened prior to seminary.
Yeah, I was involved in Baptist campus. Well, it was called Baptist State Convention at the time. No, Baptist Student Union at the time. And it was just like a campus ministry group.
Okay. So seminary, you kind of just skirted over that.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, so I do need to rewind and say that, like, my home church raised me and made me who I am, too, so I should say that, and I was really involved in youth group, so, like, super, uber involved in youth group, to where I still have a working relationship with the youth minister and his wife, who is the choir director of the church that I'm currently a member of.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, there's that, too. So, yeah, we went to Baptist Theological Seminary in Richmond, and I loved seminary at the time. It was about, it was the only option that we knew to choose.
Okay.
But now looking back, we realized we didn't know the other options. And so it was a great place to be. It was an important time to be there. We made really good friends. We learned a lot. It formed us. If I had to do it over again, of course I wouldn't change it because I wouldn't want to change where I am right now. But at the same time, if I could, like, multiply the experience, I might choose a different seminary. And that our seminary over the past several years has not continued. I mean, it's not, like, super conservative or anything, but it just hasn't continued on its really progressive way of doing things. And it's very, very focused on congregational ministry. And it was at the time, too.
Okay.
And there were a little group of us that were kind of pushing against, like, what if you don't want to be the normal pastor? What is there for us? And so we made little peer groups. And in fact, our little group of people was called, in not a kind way, we were called the social justice faction of the seminary, because it was stupid. But we, there were donuts at community conversations in seminary every single time. And the donuts were purchased from Krispy Kreme. And Greg and I and the rest of the social justice faction were asking the question, why are we not buying locally? Like, there is a donut maker in Richmond who is not a corporation.
So of course you were. Of course you were asking that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the rest of the seminary was so alarmed by our questions about donuts that they decided, like, some people started wearing Krispy Kreme t-shirts.
Oh my
God. Community conversations, and they start wearing the Krispy Kreme hats, like the paper hats that you can get at the store.
What?
Because they were just so upset. And the question was kind of like, well, no matter what you do, buying donuts is going to ruin the world and ruin people's health. And you can't not buy ingredients that are from the capitalist economy. So if you can't get out of the terrible system you're in, then why choose this other option at all? I mean, like, if you're gonna go down this terrible road to begin with, why not just go down the terrible road? It's like the question that they asked us a lot. So anyway, we joined forces because of that. And then there were more than three couples in the social justice faction, but three couples of us all moved to Charlotte at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So in 2005, we moved, and then the co-founders who lived in our neighborhood and started what at the time was called Heights, but now is called QC Family Tree, we all moved together. And then there was another couple from seminary who moved the exact same week we did, started out like normal congregational youth ministry, but still met with us and did the work of family of Hiates with us until they moved away from Charlotte.
Okay. Now, you're talking a lot, like you mentioned, what if you don't want to be kind of the typical church pastor? I think you use different words for that. Are you ordained yourself?
We are both ordained.
Okay. And what are you, which organization, which church are you ordained with?
I was ordained by First Baptist Church Raleigh, my home church, which is a progressive Baptist church. I think they currently are aligned with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship and perhaps also with the Alliance of Baptists.
Okay.
And then I became in good standing with the Disciples of Christ.
Okay.
And I was a pastor at South Park Christian Church.
Okay. So is that what you still have? Both of those? Okay. Right. What about you, Greg?
My ordination, I grew up in a Baptist world too, in the Southern Baptist world. Mm. They would not ordain me if I asked them, so I had to bother. My only affiliation now is with the Christian Church Disciples of Christ.
So, okay, well, thank you. Well, is there anything else you would add, Helms, about your journey? I mean, you kind of got through seminary and Krispy Kreme, and I didn't know if there's anything else you would add.
Well, the other thing about being... So there probably is a good theological reason why I don't want to be in the box of a normal, like, typical congregational ministerial role.
Yeah.
Although when I was a pastor in a church, I enjoyed it and often think about doing it again. So I think really the thing within me is that I always want things to be unique to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like people to tell me what to do. So, so when I'm thinking about ministry, I don't like being given a certain scenario by which I have to fit. And so it's not necessarily that I don't want to be a congregational minister. It's just that I don't want to be a conventional person.
Okay.
So anyway, that is, yeah. Like my bud Fisher, the campus minister guy, said that, like, everything that I touch has to have a little bit of me in it, which I think is every person in general, but that kind of can lead the way in which I think about things. So,
I mean,
and then I have a brother and a sister and, yeah, parents who are divorced and remarried. So that's kind of the general background.
Where are you in the birth order?
I'm the oldest.
Okay. Yeah. How much older are you?
My brother is 3 years younger than me, and my sister is 8 years younger than me.
Okay. And what about, I guess I'm going to stay with you just for a minute. I'm going to ask about motherhood later. So I have to interject this. So when you were saying that you don't like people to tell you what to do, I found myself wanting to flash the 8.
And, for sure. Yeah.
But then I heard about the whole needing it to be, like, unique to you, and that made me think about the 4.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm totally in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we've talked about that. I know we have. And I can totally see how you're an 8. So,
But I am an 8 artist, so that's the piece of the 4.
Yeah, okay, with the triad, right? I bet you have a 4 in your triad.
Probably. I've never really done that part.
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right, okay, well, we'll get back to motherhood later, and maybe I'll follow up on some of those things you said. So it does sound like it's pretty obvious that ministry and serving has been a pretty strong thread throughout your development. So, yeah. All right.
Sure.
Yeah. So, okay. What about you, Greg? Tell me, I mean, you've already kind of started Southern Baptist, but that tells me a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church, full of really terrific people. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
They taught me to love the Bible and stories of the Bible. I suspect today we'd have a lot of arguments about what that means, but they're certainly responsible for that. Yeah, so Southern Baptist taught me to love the Bible, and they also taught me to serve other people. And so we did that through, you know, a variety of ways. Especially like building houses for poor people. When I was a college student, I wound up spending 2 summers in East St. Louis, Illinois, which is along with Camden, New Jersey, the poorest city in the country, those two cities. And so just really devastated by industrial capitalism. And so I wound up living basically in the housing projects there for a summer. And as happens in those sorts of situations by the work of the Spirit, you go and live among poor people and think that you have something to offer. And what really happens is that poor people start ministering to you.
Yeah.
And so I got born again in East St. Louis, I guess.
Wow.
You could say. And loved the place and what I was learning about myself so much that I went back for a second summer and went back a number of other times to visit. And so that was really marked a turning point in my story, living amongst some of the poorest people in this country and living cross-racially as a white person in a black space was really an awakening for me. So that experience really changed the way that I learned to see the world and to see my faith and to understand myself. So when I went to seminary not too long after that, went looking for some stories and some thoughts that could help me to understand what I had experienced and how I needed to be in the world in response to that.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So how old were you then? Those experience spans.
That first summer, I think I was 19.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I guess, you know, and I like to kind of comment on where things kind of resonate with me. One of the most probably two very impactful experiences for me was one after I graduated from college. I was a psychiatric case manager for 3 years for adults. And really what that meant was it was for an agency that served people who were on, government insurance, whatever that was in Tennessee at the time. So I ended up in areas of the town I had never seen in the 22 years that I had grown up there. And it was astounding to me. Like I couldn't even wrap my mind around it, that there was this whole other town that I knew nothing of. Yeah. So I had to go as a psychiatric case manager. What you had to do was you were given a list and you had to go to their home 3 times a week because, you know, they're all about numbers and, you know, billing insurance. And, I mean, they're helping people, too, but you have to keep up your numbers. So our quota was kind of meeting with everyone 3 times a week. So they would give me a list and their address, and I would just, this was before MapQuest, like I would find them and be in these places that, I mean, and it was the combination of poverty and mental illness that was so like, it was a lot of culture shock for me, but it got into my blood. So then when I was in seminary, it was my counseling degree, we went to, LA and, for our cross-cultural class, we spent time in just communities I could never even have imagined, like cross-cultural communities in LA. So anyways, so yeah, I'm just thinking, I mean, I how those experiences really, I mean, you're really still an adolescent, 19, 22, 23, just, and even Helms, like what she experienced as a college student, how impactful that is. I mean, it just gets imprinted. It's like it becomes part of your spiritual DNA,
right.
That never really let's go. So anyway, so yeah, thanks. All right. So yeah, it just made me think, obviously my small town's not St. Louis. I'm not trying to compare my experience with you, yours at all.
Well, yeah, but sure. You saw, on the other side of town, something you didn't know existed.
Yeah.
Right. And I saw in another part of the country, something that I knew existed, but I thought that it was in the undeveloped world. Mm. I didn't think that it was in American cities.
Yeah.
That was quite disorienting for me.
Oh my gosh. I can only imagine. Yeah.
Right. And learning to locate myself in that, who am I and what am I doing here? And, what role of service can I possibly have? And
yeah,
how do I understand the faith that I've been given? If it's the question that never really settled well with me is that if my goal is to convert these folks that I'm around into some understanding of the gospel, right? But they continue to live in post-industrial capitalist destruction.
Yeah.
Then it's hard for me to see how I've really done anything to improve their lives, right? So that faith stopped making a lot of sense to me.
Okay, so let me ask you a question about that. Did you experience any, what emotions did you find yourself going through?
My immediate emotion was fear.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was, I grew up in a little tobacco town in North Carolina, in kind of rural North Carolina, not too far from Raleigh.
Which one?
In a very white world.
Fuquay.
In Fuquay, Varina. Yeah.
Okay. My dad picked tobacco growing up. He lived outside of Clinton, North Carolina. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Further down east.
Yeah.
So there was racial and fear of poor people kind of fear.
Yeah.
That I immediately felt. And, I recall a couple of situations that I wasn't equipped to understand, but there were situations that, sort of raised some of my anxiety and, with that fear.
Okay.
And that was very prominent at first, but I got over that pretty quickly because of the hospitality that I received, the ways that, both youth and adults welcomed me into their lives, was really remarkable. So following the fear, I think was, some sense of bewilderment, but also, a feeling of belonging that I couldn't really explain. I'm still not sure that I can explain it, except that it's just the hospitality of Jesus.
Wow.
It's lived out in a community like that. And so I felt like I belonged in important ways, but not fully, right? There's still some distinctions, and there's still things that I didn't know about myself that I needed to unlearn before I could ever fully belong in a place like that. But I got enough of a taste of it that I knew that there was something important happening that I needed to keep living into.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think when I asked you about the feelings, it's interesting. You said the fear, and then you kind of led into that sense of belonging, and that really kind of tells me a little bit about your journey itself. I ended up feeling some anger that I didn't, but I think it may have been because it was my own community. And because of where I went to school, my school was situated at this point in town where we had this unique combination of very wealthy people and very poor people. And so I think it triggered a lot of anger over realizing I had had no idea what some of my classmates had been going through and their world was. So anyways, I don't think my response was, I didn't have anyone really to talk to about it. So I ended up doing things like organizing a missions trip for my youth group to the other side of town and making all of my youth group go and do things over there. Because I was bound and determined to make all of them see, like, this other side of town.
Right, right.
I was also, like, 22 years old, so I'm going to give myself some grace, but I was, yeah. Anyway, I was like, I'm going to make you see what you guys have no clue about. And, of course, right. I do. I'm, like, this very enlightened person that's going to, like, you know, teach you all that at 22. I was in seminary at that point too. Anyways. All right. Yeah. You guys, I can tell by the look on your face. Like, you know, you're like, yeah, okay. All right. So what happened after that? I mean, that's just college, right?
Yeah. So we went to seminary at BTSR. Do you care about this seminary thing?
I do, actually. Okay. Is that where you guys met?
No, we met in college. We'll tell you the real story some other time, but we met in college. That's sufficient for now.
Helms is shaking her head, so yeah, and rolling her eyes.
Right, in broad strokes, the real story is that we met at summer camp. But the salacious part of the story is that she was a staffer and I was a camper.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, we shook hands when I was on staff and he was a camper. We shook hands. He loves to tell people.
That was in 1997, and she still gets a little defensive about the way this story gets told.
This is so fun. This is kind of when I'm glad you can't see me. I can just watch you guys. This is kind of okay.
All right, seminary. So I'm gonna jump into seminary time real quick. So my first day of seminary was September 11th, 2001.
Oh wow!
Yeah. And so
I was in seminary too. Then I was in class. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
So that was my very first day. And so while all that, those terrifying events were happening, I was learning how to read the Bible in Hebrew and then going to a New Testament class where we were supposed to learn to interpret the New Testament, in light of the world that we live in now. Right. So what a bizarre time.
Wow.
To try to do that in a terrifying time. But so by that point in my journey, I had figured out that, the reason the people that I loved in East St. Louis, didn't always have food in their kitchens in the wealthiest country in the world, was because capitalism is crushing our souls, right? And it was crushing our souls and still is. And the post-industrial wasteland that had been created there, that all those beautiful people had learned to survive and to flourish in some ways, that they were doing that in spite of the system and not because of it. And so what happened after September 11th, of course, very quickly was that it was seized on the opportunity to go to war, a war that we're still in, some years later, 17, and war, generally speaking, profits some few people at the cost of the lives of people who live in East St. Louis or who live in our neighborhood now.
Yeah.
And I had gotten hip to that already. And so I began to get in touch with my own anger as I watched. We were learning this progressive theology, and we were reading the liberationists. We were reading this radical stuff in some cases. But then people were going from this educational institution into churches that still didn't have enough gumption to stand up against these illegal and immoral wars that we're prosecuting in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I'd sort of left the Southern Baptists on the one hand, feeling like there wasn't an answer there to what I had experienced in the world, and walked into this progressive theological situation to find out that they didn't take discipleship seriously enough to claim the Prince of Peace was actually the Prince of Peace. So for us, rather than running away, which was tempting at times, I think the answer or the trajectory has been to try to dive deeper into the, and that's what radical means, right? To be radical is simply to be thorough, or the Latin root, like the word radish is the word root. So to get at the root of the issues, to get at the root of what living the faith means. And so we keep trying to dive deeper as best we can in the places that we find ourselves. And also, but we do keep trying to put ourselves in the way of the ugliest sides of our society, the places where there's the most suffering and oppression, and to stand in solidarity there.
Wow, I had never heard of that definition of radical. So, thank you. That's new information for me, and I really, really, really love that image. So, thank you. Okay, yeah, that really... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Just quick. The people who have been residents here, interns, and us, whenever there are some, when we have our little business meetings to talk about ministry and calendar and all the daily stuff,
yeah,
we call it a radish meeting.
Oh, wow. Really? A radish meeting. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Okay. Oh, my gosh. I mean, there's been different experiences I've had with people where they've taught me what a word actually means, and it stays with me. For example, I had a supervisor way back in California. I mean, we're talking 14 years ago, and he taught me that the word educate is the Latin word of it, really literally means to draw out. And that very short conversation has influenced even my pedagogy, right? I mean, it influences the way I teach.
Right.
So thank you. It's going to probably stay with me. Radical. Okay. All right. Thank you. I just like finding out, of course, I didn't know all those details, and knowing your story just helps kind of place things in context. So I guess now, what are you doing now? Talk a little bit about that. What's going on now? What are you guys doing? Where are you? And yeah, what do you do?
Are we supposed to know how to answer that question?
I think what do you do and the meaning of life feels so very well connected that it's kind of like, I don't know. Okay, so we know at least like kind of time-wise. We moved in 2005. We were living in an intentional community, had a common pot with another couple, shared a house, shared all things in common. And we did that for 8 years. And also, so like that's a big piece. And in those 8 years, we had two major conflicts and had counseling both of the times. One was year three and one was year eight. And then at like year eight and a half or nine, they left. So that's like a big thing. And then we also were setting out to be practicing hospitality and solidarity. And then that grew into solidarity with neighbors. And then that grew into also youth leadership and youth programming. And so fast forward, add all those things together, and that's now. And now you have what we are now. So we live and work in the same neighborhood that we've been in for 13 years. The neighborhood up until about 2015 had been predominantly low income, African American. It still is predominantly that way, but it's shifting. And we have been offering hospitality in our home. And then when QC Family Tree acquired other properties, we started to add places in which we were offering hospitality, but in different ways. So it used to be that people would just stay for free in our house until they could get up on their feet, and we'd have some kind of case-by-case basis by which we would figure out how that works. And now we have actual apartments that people sign applications and leases and are renting affordably and turning in rent on time and as agreed upon. So we kind of provide all of those opportunities still, but we more so provide the opportunities for the affordable housing rentals than we do just somebody staying in our house for a short period of time.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. We also provide housing to interns or people. So in the past, we've thought of it as being a nesting place, not just for people who are transitional or like homeless or being evicted, but also people who are in discernment. So we've provided quite a bit of housing and also like space for interns, people who are discerning what in the world to do with their life or how to live in community or what kind of ministry they want to be a part of. And so we have part-time interns, whether they be summer-long or semester-long. We also have a little bit more full-time interns, like year-long. We haven't had anybody since the other co-founders left about 3 or 4 years ago. And we haven't had anybody that's just, like, determined they're going to stay here for all time. Though we have neighbors who we hope will stay here for lengths of time. But they just have a different kind of relationship to us. They don't, you know, sweep the house and cook for divas. They do other things, like I call them and say, hey, I need you to help me, please, to pick up the boys from the bus stop because I'm running late. That kind of thing. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I want to go back and just for some clarification. So the organization that you guys run, and forgive me if my language doesn't really fit your ethos or what you're trying to do. So is the Queen City Family Tree.
QC, yep.
Yeah,
QC.
It doesn't really actually say Queen City on any documents. It just says QC.
Oh, okay, QC Family Tree. Okay. And you guys live in, how would you, okay, in a neighborhood that is predominantly low income.
Yeah, the neighborhood's called Enderley Park.
Enderley Park, yeah.
Yeah, most of our neighbors live near or below the federal poverty guideline.
What is the guideline?
So the median income here is $25,000 or so a year. The median income in the city of Charlotte as a whole is slightly over $70,000 a year. So our neighbors live mostly at about 30% or so of the median income in our city as a whole.
Okay. Okay.
The poverty guideline varies depending on the family size.
Sure.
And I'm not looking at it now, but that $25,000 range for a place like Charlotte is at or slightly below the federal poverty guideline.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the 8 years where you and another family lived closely together. And how would you guys, I think I even remember talking with you, there was this sense in which there was a very contemplative piece of that. I'm not sure what the right language is. Like, you guys were pretty intentional about your community.
Yeah. So there was a sort of a little springing up of a whole bunch of communities, starting about between 10 and 15 years ago. And there was some language given to that that was the new monasticism.
Right, okay.
And so that you can imagine it as sort of like a postmodern spin on monasticism. So that rather than taking vows of poverty, charity, and chastity for folks to live in community, these were like families and young singles who weren't necessarily going to remain single, living together in marginalized places on the edge of the empire, who were sharing their lives in common, who were working in ministries, in neighborhood-based ministries together, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But also who were building their days, like monastics do, around a rhythm of prayer and community life.
Yeah, yeah. Do you guys still have any of that rhythm as part of your day?
We still have some of it, yeah. So we have the seasons of the year sort of flex things for us. We began every morning with breakfast together, and for now it's the two of us and our two boys, where we read the Bible together and we pray for folks together. We read the comic book Bible right now.
Oh, that's so cool. The action Bible. Okay. Awesome. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Oh, they absolutely love it. We have read through it at least three times now.
Okay, I may have to find it.
Yeah. I do need to say that people are more pale than they ought to be, but they're still not totally white.
Okay.
And sometimes the angels are blonde.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to be ready to talk about all that stuff when you're going to read it. So we read the Bible together in the morning. We frequently will pause at midday for a short midday prayer liturgy. And that's something that we learned from this book called The Common Prayer that was put together by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and Shane Claiborne and Enuma Okoro. And lots of communities like ours and lots of other folks who are just like-minded utilize that all around the country, maybe even around the world. So... And then we eat our evening meal together, and we're very careful about carving out time for that. And so when we have guests here, when we have interns, then we're very intentional, at least four and sometimes five or six nights a week, eating at least one meal together as part of our regular routine.
Yeah, I find that all pretty beautiful, so thank you for telling me a little bit more about that. I've actually, the idea of rhythm comes up for me quite often and something I've been thinking about even the last couple of days. And of course, just in, practical family sense, I think the family meal is so, so healthy for kids. It's really, really important for their development. So, okay, hang on. I was just writing down the Action Bible in my notes, so I lost track of my question. So, hang on. I know from just following you guys on social media and having conversations with you that the issues kind of coming together around race and housing and privilege are important pieces of your work. And so I guess what I'm wondering is how is this work important? Why is this work important in Charlotte? And then how is Charlotte the same and different than other cities?
All right. So working backwards through your questions, Charlotte is very similar to other cities in the housing issues that we're facing. Housing in some ways is just shorthand for land. Like what are we, how are we going to utilize the common resource that we have of land in order to meet the needs of the people who share that land? So we are facing very similar issues to issues many other cities around the country are facing, especially in larger growing cities across the Sun Belt. So in Dallas and in Houston and New Orleans and Atlanta, Raleigh, they're facing the same set of issues. So in Charlotte, like the practical thing is that we lack 34,000 units of housing for people living at 80% of our area median income and below. And that's a lot. That's a huge amount. The need is really stark at 50% of the area median income and below. So we're lacking 20 to 24,000 units of housing. And at that level of income, it becomes very difficult to solve the problem through market-based solutions. There have to be subsidies in order to make all the expenses work, in other words. So it's going to require lots and lots of resources from lots of different sources to solve that large-scale systemic problem. It's also really important to note that it is a systemic problem. We have this issue because of decisions that we've made about how the city of Charlotte is built over the past 50 or even 100 years. So we didn't just wake up with this problem. It's been developing for a long time. So part of the reason for that is because we've subsidized the suburbs. We've subsidized it by building highways. And typically those highways were built through black neighborhoods. And so at the same time we were subsidizing the white suburbs, we were also destroying black neighborhoods, most famously the Brooklyn neighborhood and what's now called Second Ward. In downtown Charlotte, but also if you drive through Interstate 77, anywhere within a couple of miles of uptown, those were formerly primarily black neighborhoods whose people were run off of their land and it was seized and they were given very small amounts of money in comparison to the actual value of that land. So this is a systemic issue that is still creating problems 40 or 50 years later, which is how long it's been since we started building those highways.
Wow.
Greg has been like, he's been the speaker at every event lately. So he has like this kind of thing that he does. He's really good at it. But the other piece is like today I went on a neighborhood walk and a lady who has lived in her house for 11 years is now having to move because there is a new owner and they're putting her out and they're going to renovate the house and then they're going to flip it and they're going to make a big buck off of it and she's not going to have a place to live. So like the abstract stuff is really important. It's not even abstract. It's real. But at the same time, like Deidre is going to be homeless in a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
And so like today when I went around on the walk, it was like, I got kind of caught up for a moment because we're doing this thing where we both gave each other assignments this week because we were kind of in a rut so far as our schedules and how we use our day.
Yeah.
And so Greg gave me some assignments. I gave him some assignments and they're supposed to like kind of wake us up a little bit. Well, one of mine was about taking pictures in the neighborhood. So one of mine was exercise. So I'm walking around the neighborhood, and I start getting this idea that I should just take pictures of all the houses that are being shifted right now, because if I took pictures of the houses, then like this week, then I could wait 2 months, take another picture and the house would be vastly changed. And then I got like in this analysis paralysis, because that means that I'm going to have to take a picture of every damn house in the whole entire neighborhood. Like every house, I can look at the house and say, Desmond lived there 2 months ago and was put out, his family was put out because it changed ownership, it's being flipped, someone's making money off of it. Like that's Oh, I mean, not every house, but only 30% of the houses in our neighborhood are home-owned. So that's 70% of the houses in our neighborhood are the neighbors are changing, and they're likely changing to a higher economic bracket.
Yeah.
So that shifts our identity. It shifts our culture. It shifts our sense of calling. It shifts everything about us as, like, just individuals, which is, you know, not the be-all, end-all of the world, but at the same time, like, how does it affect us? That's how it affects
us.
Yeah, that's big, too.
Yeah.
So all those systemic factors, like, they get visited upon the bodies and the spirits of our neighbors here. And they, when we built the suburbs and the highways, then those decisions were also visited upon the grandmothers and the aunties and uncles of our neighbors here, right? So the same people keep suffering from the systemic decisions that we're making.
Yeah.
So the displacement is not just displacement, it's that it's serial displacement. We take the same population of folks and we move them around, we shuffle them around to whatever is the next undesirable place.
Wow. So I know that as much as this may be shocking to you, there are a lot of people out there who really do not know what gentrification is. Like I remember talking to a family member and mentioning what that was, and they honestly, you could tell they didn't understand. They didn't understand anything of what you just said. They didn't get it. So could you talk a little bit about gentrification?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And in terms of power and privilege, like the fact that this can remain hidden from some people is part of the power and privilege, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The luxury of not having to notice it. So gentrification was coined by this, the term itself was coined by this British sociologist back in the 60s. And what she was trying to describe was the effect of the gentry class, right? That's sort of a British word, the gentry, moving into what had been some disinvested neighborhoods in somewhere in a small city in England. And so she was trying to describe the sets of changes that were taking place culturally, economically, and also trying to track the displacement of those lower income people who were living in that place. So functionally, that's what gentrification is. It's an attempt to describe the redevelopment of neighborhoods by wealthier classes of people. And so in the United States, of course, we have a racial caste system where black folks generally, we have a racial caste system where in our cities, the neighborhoods that we think of as being the most blighted or the poorest or the most troubled are generally the neighborhoods where large numbers of people of color live, especially black people.
Yeah.
But not exclusively black people. And so the reasons that those neighborhoods are blighted in many cases is simply because there's no money available in those neighborhoods. It can't be lent because of bank policy, because of federal policy. And there's the economics are screwed up by the mass incarceration system that takes young men at the most productive times of their lives, increasingly young women, and locks them up in cages. And so what happens is that neighborhoods become very destabilized. And so gentrification describes the process by which folks recognize that this is cheap real estate and we can begin to make a significant profit off of it by beginning to buy up that real estate, those houses and the vacant land that exists and commercial properties, and to redevelop them. And so there, it's a systemic thing, but there's definitely like an ethos that goes along with it. The hipster kind of thing, right? So the first thing that shows up in gentrification, if you buy the caricatures, is the coffee shop. And then there's a dog park, and then there's like somebody's artisanal pickle boutique, and there's a brewery. and there's, you know, a little shishi, like handmade goods that the average person can't afford, that kind of thing.
Shishi. Okay, this is a new word for me. What is shishi?
The things that the gentry would buy. The shishi.
People I'm playing tennis with on Wednesday.
Yeah, right. The country club members, they wouldn't come to this side of town even after it's gentrified, but if they did, they would come for those little boutiques, the shishi ones.
Shishi. Okay, this is new. I've never heard of that phrase. I can't wait to incorporate it into my daily conversation.
Yeah. So all that's the visible signs of gentrification, but the groundwork for it is laid decades before in disinvestment. So the city hasn't invested any new money over here for years and years, right? But now all of a sudden we're getting a traffic circle, and we've gotten some new sidewalks fairly recently, and we got some bike lanes a few years ago. And so this investment starts to come back after decades of disinvestment, where everybody who owns something stopped taking care of it, stopped investing in it, until it became profitable again. So that's gentrification. It is really that system, and the last stages of it are when the mustachioed guys and their fancy coffee show up. And by that time, the battle has already been lost if you're fighting against it, because all the undergirding of it has already been done at that point.
So how is that related to, I've seen, I guess mostly you, the posts about you, I don't know if it would be considered vandalizing, where you take the signs.
That's guerrilla activism. Yes. That's artivism at its best.
Wait, guerrilla activism at its best?
Uh-huh.
Or artivism.
Artivism. Ooh, I'm learning all kinds of new words with you guys. Artivism. So tell me about the artivism. Everyone really should go to your home. It's an experience. So,
it's a tourist destination.
Yes. I'm going to contribute to, you guys can just become part of like this neighborhood icon, and everyone with their gentrified coffee can find you guys as being incredibly cute and, they'll have their community garden, and maybe they'll want you to keep their chickens for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll start the chicken co-op with the new ones that come in. So you're talking about the We Buy Houses signs?
Yes, the We Buy Houses signs, yes.
Okay. So about in 2015... We Buy Houses signs started showing up in the neighborhood and in West Charlotte. And I think probably in East Charlotte too, probably mostly in the Crescent areas. Mm-hmm. Now they seem to be growing into other spaces, but we noticed, neighbors and I noticed these signs, and together with some neighbors and some other community organizers that were from the West Side, but not necessarily from this particular neighborhood, we started to re-message them. So several of us would just grab them off the street. I mean, they're litter anyway. They're not supposed to be there. I have looked it up, so don't fact check me, but I cannot imagine that is a thing that is allowed. I mean, they're not voting signs. It's not like a political campaign.
Right.
It is. So mostly there, we buy houses signs, there are the diabetes signs, and there's like the get your credit fixed up right type signs. So anyway, we just, several of us picked up the we buy houses signs, and we figured, well, I mean, they're in the neighborhood, they're a resource we can use. So we use them for art projects. We've used them to build like playhouses.
Really?
We've used them for children and family programming when we've been talking about certain lessons, that we've used them as a kind of a canvas with which to work. But anyway, when we remessaged them, we would find a way to take away the phone number, find a way to remessage the sign, and then just put them straight back out into the spaces that they were to begin with. So they would say, we live in houses, and then they would cover up the phone number, or they would just be artwork, like silhouettes of people that you could imagine living in this space. And then when we got to the point where repainting every single sign got to be a bit too much, then we also purchased some different stickers that we could put onto the numbers of the sign, the phone number, so that it would say, for example, it would say nope over the phone number, or the newest one says, my home is not your investment. There's also an artist named Janelle Dunlap who's made one that looks like colonizers, like literally like Sir Walter Raleigh is standing there with his like frilly collared shirt, and he's talking to an indigenous person, someone who looks like they're Native American, and he's got this we buy houses sign, so it's kind of like connecting the dots between what's happening now and colonization. So we put those on the signs as well over the phone numbers. So we did that for two and a half years or so. Yeah. We still have the bumper stickers, and we still do some of that. Sometime around when Philando Castile, when he died, we'd already been through several cases of police brutality, and every time that we go through that experience, I personally am overwhelmed with the fact that that could definitely be one of the children that I interact with on a regular basis. And that overwhelms me with sadness and fear for a length of time. So kind of a therapeutic thing for me is to work that out through repainting those signs. And so what one time I did, like, I thought about the particular youth that we had and made portraits in a real kind of like more like graphic design way, not really a fine arts way, and then put each of those portraits on the sign, and then put the sign out in front of that particular kid's house. So, you know, there was one that was dedicated to a particular kid, and then it was in his front yard for a period of time. So we've used them in a number of ways. And there's still some that we've repainted that are out on the road. And then of course the bumper stickers, we're leaning more towards bumper stickers right now, just cause we've been painting them for 3 years.
Wow. Yeah.
So a little context, the signs, you'll see them in a lot of neighborhoods. They just say like, we'll buy your house for cash. And I'll have a phone number on them. And so this is, these are sort of the vulture investors who are trying to buy stuff from people who are in precarious positions.
Yeah.
So a lot of our neighbors are, if they own their homes, can be equity rich, but cash poor. And so making the repairs that need to be made on a place, often is a challenge.
Yeah.
And so these folks will swoop in, and so several of them actually called us today. So I asked one guy, make us an offer, right, just to see what he would say. And so his offer is about 50% of what the house is actually worth.
Wow.
Fair market.
Wow.
And so the whole business plan is around finding vulnerable people who are, who they can take advantage of through these kind of real estate deals.
Because one guy contacted Greg's sister-in-law to get our information. Wow. And one guy contacted Greg's, no, Greg's actual sister and Greg's father. Both have been contacted about a house that QC Family Tree owns because they want to purchase it.
And
like, this is like through Facebook.
Right. And you guys know, you have the knowledge of how much the house is worth, but some people may not have that information. And I don't know. Does that?
Yeah, that's one of the ways that I think folks take advantage.
I think word of mouth might be spreading. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not going to take place, but because Wesley Heights had this happen to them years ago, there's been enough conversation that I think people are kind of aware. And then in about a year and a half or so ago, we tried to go door to door to everyone that we could, that own their home, to help them to understand like what they could do if someone was to approach them. So since the conversation around gentrification and displacement is gaining some traction, I think more people know to wait to sell, or not to sell at all, than they did perhaps when it was happening to Wesley Heights.
Now, could there be situations I've heard in which they get told because they can't make the repairs, they're going to be fined or cited, and that's scary for them, and so then they sell out of fear?
Yes, so the fines can accumulate, and they can eventually result in the city taking your land. So one of the common schemes, there's one real estate company that has kind of built their business off of this, is showing up with a cash offer, and then if a landowner won't sell, then calling code enforcement to report some issues. And then once the fines become obvious and the homeowner is not able to make the repairs that code enforcement offers to make, then they show up with another cash offer. So now there's kind of some outside pressure being applied. So people start to play dirty in order to make money.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. No, that's really helpful. Thank you for explaining your take on gentrification. And I love hearing about your artivism. Yeah. I really love, okay, I'm not going to use it. Well, you've turned the shed behind your house into this art room.
Right.
So it's really a beautiful place, and your garden's really beautiful too. What kind of things do you do in that space back there?
We have two different art studio spaces. One is particularly just for pottery. And so I teach classes to adults in the neighborhood. It's actually a combo class. Some adults in the neighborhood and some non-neighbors take the class together. And they just simply get to make something out of clay, make something out of nothing, and then take it home.
Okay.
And then we had in the past a program where the youth group has taken pottery classes. They have made items, and then we've sold them, and then they get some of the paycheck from the sales. So we've done both of those things. And then the other art studio, I mean, everything always shifts around here, but the other art studio has been used for mixed media art workshops and kind of imagining space.
Yeah.
And we are currently thinking about like maybe half and half. The studio will be mixed media, but it will also be a space for like a bike repair shop, because we have our youth group. About 3 years ago, shifted from a group of high school girls that were mostly introverts to a bunch of rambunctious boys. And so with their personalities in mind, right now they need to move their bodies as much as possible.
Yeah.
And so a bike studio would, or a bike like workshop would help us to get everybody's bikes up to par after they do a wheelie, and then they skid out, and then the gear changer comes off or whatever it is that happens. So that's that other space. But we've been just brainstorming with how do we put in the flesh the things that we believe.
Yeah.
And so We believe that God is a creator and that God calls us to creation with God. And so how do we put that into reality? So that's the art studio and the gardening. We also believe that place is important and sacred. And so that makes us think about, like, how is our place set up, and in which, how is it designed so that it draws people into community and it draws people into engagement with one another. It draws people into being inspired and a sense of wonder. So we try to make attempts at that in all of our spaces, and some of the growth in that will kind of like ebb and flow. Like, we will have the beautiful garden in the summer and we'll feel like this is the heaven on earth, and then the garden dies in the winter, and we look out the window and we think this is the most terrible thing we've ever seen in our lives, and we wonder how in the world we could ever enjoy such a thing, and then it comes back. So wow. It's never like just this, like, it's not an amusement park where it's always feeling like it's just right, but it's always kind of a trying again and again to dip into how can we make real the story of our faith and also make real what we believe.
Okay. I think you've already kind of gotten to this. Is there anything else you want to say about why housing is an issue of privilege and power?
So there's an African proverb that says that when the white man showed up, he had the Bible and the people had the land. But when the white man left, they had the land and the people had the Bible. All right, so that's kind of the history that we're talking about when we're talking about housing issues. And so there's like one of the basic stories of faith is the story of hospitality and of the way that God comes to inhabit our neighborhoods and is welcomed by peasants and is not welcomed by powerful people. And so, like, if that's the story of our faith, then that demands something of us in the ways that we build our neighborhoods and the ways that we open the doors of our houses. And so, like, those are basic justice issues. Everybody's got to have a place to live.
Wow, yeah.
In the troubled history, racial and economic history of our country, people don't always have a place to live.
Yeah.
And there's not a compelling reason for that. It's simply, the only reason is greed. There are certainly enough resources. There are many people that have more than one house.
Yeah.
So, you know, fundamentally, everybody needs a place to stand, a place to lay their heads, and some dirt to be connected to. And if we can't do that as people of faith and as people of goodwill working together in a society, then there's not much else we can do. Like, everything is built on that. So, you know, if we're going to get at the root, then we have to begin with the land that we occupy.
Wow.
And our relationship to it.
Okay. Thank you. So if someone wanted to get involved with you guys, with QC Family Tree, where would they go? What could they do?
They could go to QCFamilyTree.org, or where we have Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at QC Family Tree. So that's a start, or they can email us. It's our first names, and then at QCFamilyTree.org is our email addresses. It's important to us that people who want to have long-term relationships take the time that requires, and that those are the long-term volunteers and relationships are the most transformative for both neighbors and the volunteer. That said, we know that people need and want, like, one-time activities or tasks or projects to complete. And so we always have like donation needs and volunteer opportunities that could just be kind of like a, you do this and then you've enjoyed that experience and you go on to do other things, and that's acceptable too. And so we have like a calendar of events, a donation needs, and all that kind of stuff on our website. And then they can sign up for our email list. And our email list, we send out an email once a month. And the email helps people to know what's going on in the upcoming month and what they can get involved in. Especially, I don't know when this podcast is going out, but it will have Freedom School opportunities for volunteers in the summer, and then other summer programming volunteers, volunteer opportunities that will be coming up that we'll put out on our email newsletter.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, all right, I think I'm going to stop with that, but I want to ask you, you guys are obviously doing work that is pretty all encompassing. Like, you guys, I mean, this is morning, noon, and night. Clearly, this is things you guys are investing in. I mean, this is your whole life. So I want to know, how do you guys take care of yourselves? What is your self-care? What does that look like?
Well, the way, the busyness of our lives is seasonal. So the things we have to think about, how we have to think about things changes depending upon the season. So if kids are out of school, we do a lot of things with kids in the neighborhood. And so if kids are out of school, then our like physical energy is up, and also our like problem solving, trying to figure out how we're getting to whatever field trip, all that kind of stuff. But then like in the winter time, when people aren't out as much, when we're not interacting with as many people, our kind of energy is kind of consumed by like, who are we? What are we about? What kind of things do we need to be discerning? What do we need for nourishment? So I think one of the things about self-care for us is that we finally have recognized that like summer is our intense time. And so we don't have this like moment when we're scared, because we're working so hard. We don't know what to do with that anymore. Because we know to expect it now.
Yeah.
So, like I equate it to when we were youth ministers in the normal sense, and we went to youth camp. And like Wednesday, the youth ministers would proclaim that this is angry day. Like every seventh grade girl is going to get angry on this day. There's going to be some drama. People are going to get out of hand. And it's just because it's like the third or fourth day of camp. And that's just how it is. And so like once you could name it, then you could see it and sort of disassociate and be like, oh, this is angry day. No problem. Like, I don't need to get all up in arms about that. That's just what this is. And so for us, the summer and like the late spring is a time when we can just be like, oh, this is just what this is like. And we're not scared of it. We know what it is. We can turn to each other and be like, I need 20. I need 20 minutes. I need to close the door and not have anybody talk to me and just power nap or whatever. So that's one thing. It's just like knowing and admitting what the season is,
yeah,
and being okay with the fact that it's a season. The same is true for like the winter. Like the winter, we don't see as many people. We're doing some discernment about our identity or what role we have in life now. And all of a sudden I get in like this existential crisis where I'm like, I'm making an impact in the world and I don't know what to do with my life. And maybe I need to change all the things. And then I need to be like, no, it's winter and I just haven't seen people today. It's okay. So that's one big piece of self-care that I think has been helpful as we've observed how things work. But aside from that, we try our best to give ourselves permission to rest.
Mm.
We try our best to give ourselves permission to change. Mm. For instance, what is currently the pottery studio was once a yoga studio. Before that, it was a youth group hangout. It's also been resident space, and that permission to shift even mm-hmm. in like the physical places lends itself to a lot of freedom and mm-hmm. a lot less guilt about what we should have done or what we told people we were going to do, those kinds of things. So those are some things.
Wow,
and then
I love that.
Plays music. I do artwork. We both try to exercise a lot. We both eat relatively healthfully, especially since we're Americans. But I would say that, like, the self-care thing is a thing that people have been talking about a lot. It seems like more, like, it came up into, like, a trendy thing around when the movement for Black Lives was happening, at least in my realm. That's where self-care and the comments about self-care came up.
Wow.
And it was kind of like people were becoming and learning how to be activists, and then they realized that they also need to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And so, so one of the things that I'm wishing for and wanting for is that, self-care is important and healthy and good. It's also very individualistic.
Yeah.
In that, like, I have to take care of myself.
Hmm.
And, we haven't yet built, an environment or kingdom or world or community or village in which other people are necessarily taking care of me at the rate that I need to be taken care of. And so another piece of self-care is like brainstorming, okay, how can we together be creating this thing that eventually I am being taken care of? Like, we are interdependent and I'm not just taking care of other people. And then all of a sudden being like, oh, that's right, I need to take care of myself too.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a mutual thing. So, the other piece about that is, Walter Brueggemann has done a lot of stuff about Sabbath as resistance.
Yeah.
And like, the act of stopping production,
yeah,
is actually an act of resistance. And so I try to hold on to that in the moments where I feel like I need to do whatever's on my calendar, or I need to accomplish such and such, or I need to like hone my message. That's the moment where I'm like, okay, maybe I also need to just like nap.
Yeah.
Or, maybe I also need to take a minute and...
I love his book on Sabbath.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty powerful. Just the name of his book, Sabbath as Resistance, is really great. There's
yeah.
so many Brueggemann concepts that I actually carry with me into my teaching and even therapy. Like his book on the Psalms, the whole idea of orientation, disorientation, and reorientation
yes.
is huge, huge for me. Huge. So, yeah, good stuff.
Greg's in a cohort with him right now.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
it's
my
pretty God. Awesome.
You're in a cohort with Walter Brueggemann? Like, what does that even mean?
I'm in the cohort. He's kind of the guru for it. We're talking about the new economy, building a space for abundance in a world of scarcity. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I'm sure it is. That's great. Congratulations on being in the country club of theologians there. Right, yeah. You still wearing your tennis skirt today?
Yeah. After that, I'm never taking it off.
Okay, I do gotta ask. I've gotta ask. Like, I knew Helms was an 8. What are you, Greg? Because I know Helms and I were talking about this. Can I guess?
Yeah.
Are you a 5?
No.
No?
No.
Okay, are you a 2?
No, that's a good guess, though.
Okay, I'm just gonna stop.
I'm a 9.
Oh, no, that makes sense.
Yeah. I score. When I take the assessment, like when Helms takes the assessment, it's like, oh yeah, she's an 8. That's clear.
Yeah.
I think it's probably kind of typical of 9. I kind of score fairly evenly along a number of things.
Yeah.
Including the 5. And I have a lot of 2 kind of energy.
Yeah. Well, the helping and serving, and the 5, I think maybe I'm picking up just the introversion, quiet, focused thinking
right.
kind of piece. But the 9, that whole perspective taking, and yeah, that all makes sense to me too. That's interesting. Huh. Have you guys listened to that? Do you know Sleeping at Last, the group Sleeping at Last?
No.
It's actually one person. It used to be a group, but now it's just one person, but he's kept just the sleeping at last. He is writing a song for each number in the Enneagram. And so he's
the guy that's working with Chris Huritz.
Maybe. Anyways,
okay, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's fine. I've interrupted plenty of times tonight. But 1, 2, 3, and 4, he's written the first. He's going in order. So, but yeah, they're actually really good, really really good. So, anyways, okay. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer because now I've kept you.
I have to say one other thing.
Okay.
And that is that I have written a book that I want your listeners to read.
You guys are like, there's like some snarky looks there, so I gotta know.
Because he's self-promoting and we're weird about that. We're not really good at it.
What's the book?
So I wrote a book. It is titled A Riff of Love and has a subtitle that says Notes on Community and Belonging. And the book is stories from QC Family Tree and from Enderley Park. And gentrification comes up as one of the layers of those stories, but it's mostly about people that I've come to love and who have been teachers and friends to me here. And it's about some really significant and formative events, some of them funny and some of them heartbreaking.
Yeah.
That have happened on this corner. So the book's going to be out probably in mid-June from Cascade Books. And I'm pretty excited about that.
That is really incredible, Greg. That's awesome. Congratulations. And thank you for self-promoting and so that I can know about it. Yeah, that's awesome. I would love to tell people about it. Actually, I'm trying to figure out how I could make my class read it. Where are they going to be able to buy it? I guess Amazon. I bet it'll be on Amazon, but where else? You probably have an issue with Amazon, so I'm trying to figure out where.
I mean, you know, you just do what you can. We buy stuff from Amazon. So you can actually, as a professor, you can get a desk copy. So you can take a look at it and see if you want, if it would be useful for you. It'll be available through my publisher. Hopefully it'll be available through Park Road Books here.
That's,
or through Amazon.
Okay. That's awesome. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to follow up. Okay, you guys have a great night.
All right. We'll see you.
Okay, bye. Hi there. My name is Emily Stone, actually Dr. Emily Stone, but I hope in these conversations you will think of and refer to me as just Emily. I am a marriage and family therapist and have a long history of work in local churches. I also teach in an accredited graduate school program that trains marriage and family.